My name is Dr. Lewis Myers, and this is Healthcare Today. Each week on this show, we will welcome a specialist who will share with us new developments in adult and pediatric medicine, as well as a range of other healthcare issues. This is an interactive program, and we will open the phones to your on-air questions and comments. I hope you'll stay with us, because together we're going to learn something about healthcare. Good afternoon. This is Dr. Lewis Myers, and you're listening to Healthcare Today. October has for many years been designated as Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and in honor of that, we're going to focus today on breast cancer screening, diagnosis, treatment, and prevention. While breast cancer is still a major source of cancer in women and a major source of mortality, there is significant progress being made, and we're going to talk about that today. We have three guests, three physicians who are actively working in the field of breast cancer. Dr. Andrew Boyer is a radiologist at Rutland Regional Medical Center. Dr. Alan Eisman is medical oncologist at Rutland Regional Medical Center and the director of the Foley Cancer Center. And Dr. David Weintritt is a breast surgeon in Alexandria, Virginia. Welcome to all of you, and I'm going to start with Dr. Boyer, and let me tell you briefly his background. Dr. Boyer is from Vermont. He went to Burr and Burton Academy, went to St. Lawrence University as an undergraduate, and then to medical school at the University of Vermont. He did his radiology residency at Beaumont Hospital in Michigan, and he did one additional year in breast imaging fellowship at the Beaumont Hospital. Dr. Boyer, welcome to you.
Thank you very much for having me on.
We want to talk first about screening for breast cancer. I know in recent years there's been a lot of controversy among different agencies in regards to breast cancer screening recommendations. For example, the American Cancer Society has one set of recommendations. The United States Preventive Services has another, and other groups have additional ones. Can you sort that out for us? Why is there such a controversy, and what is the most common recommendations now for breast cancer screening?
Absolutely, and that is a great question because the waters have been muddied over the past couple of years. But before I go into that, I'm just going to take one step back and just kind of talk about why we screen for breast cancer at all. What's the goal there? And really the goal is to find small breast cancers in women who have no symptoms. So we don't want to find breast cancers when they're big enough for someone to feel or for a clinician to feel. We want to find them earlier. We want to find them before they spread. And that's the whole goal of screening and of screening mammograms. So the classic recommendations or the historical recommendations over several decades now have been that every woman starting at age 40 have a screening mammogram every year. And like I said, the waters have been muddied quite a bit over the past 5 or 10 years as different organizations have put out different recommendations. So, you know, you might read in the New York Times or in even the medical literature, there are still organizations recommending that same every year starting at age 40. There are now recommendations saying, you know, every other year is okay, or starting at age 50 is okay. It really comes down to the science behind it and the research behind it. A lot of the organizations that recommend starting screening at age 50 and doing every other year include in their analysis two major studies that were done in Canada that were very flawed from a study design standpoint, and I won't go into the details of it, but basically every study that has ever been done on screening mammograms shows a survival benefit, meaning that if a group of women have a mammogram, they are less likely to die from breast cancer than women who do not, except those Canadian studies. And basically, they put people who were already symptomatic in the mammogram unit, so of course they had higher level disease than the people that didn't have a lump that a physician could feel. So if you examine the data using good, well-designed studies, there's about a 40% mortality reduction when you have a screening mammogram. So that's where most of the societies that and organizations that recommend a mammogram every year beginning at age 40, they take the good, in my mind, they take the good science and kind of leave out the poorly designed studies. And so the American Cancer Society, NCCN guidelines, the American College of Radiology, Society of Breast Imaging, Academy of Obstetrics and Gynecologists, just to name a few, still recommend the starting at age 40 and having a mammogram every year. And that's my recommendation as well.
Is there a downside to having a mammogram beginning at age 40?
So there are a few downsides. Any time that, you know, if we're looking for something, if we're doing mammograms, the goal is to find cancer, right? The goal is to find an early stage cancer. Occasionally, we will find things that look suspicious on imaging, and we do a biopsy and they turn out to be benign. So the risks really are, There's a low level, number one, there's a low level of radiation with mammograms. They use X-ray technology. So there's a theoretical risk of radiation. I will tell you that is extremely low. The low level of radiation is probably causes no health, no adverse health effects at all, but that is a theoretical risk. And the other risk is, do we find lesions that are benign? And so we have patients who undergo unnecessary biopsies. Again, that number is very low. So to me, it all comes down to a risk-reward benefit. And the risks are relatively low, and the rewards or the potential rewards are to find early-stage breast cancers in younger patients who we can treat and have a longer life to live if we find it early.
What about the other end of the life spectrum when women are older, many years past menopause? At what age would you recommend that mammograms stop? Or is there any cutoff point?
Yeah, great question too. And again, the water is very muddy here as well. Some organizations recommend a cutoff at age 75. Some recommend at menopause. Some recommend at age 80. I don't like those arbitrary numbers because not every 75-year-old is the same, right? There are some very, very healthy 75-year-olds. There are some 75-year-olds who have very advanced medical conditions or might have an advanced other type of cancer. So the recommendation that I give my patients is, and when I talk to my referring clinician colleagues, is basically to do a mammogram up until the point where someone has about a 10 year or more life expectancy. Meaning if you're healthy, keep having your mammogram, right, beyond an arbitrary age of 75. So it's that 10-year life expectancy that I tend to recommend.
That's helpful. And let me ask you about breast imaging modalities. Has there been an improvement, and can you tell us a little bit about what digital mammography offers, what ultrasound offers, and when you would recommend an MRI of the breast?
Absolutely. So there's different types of mammograms. The original was screen film. That's kind of before the digital age. Basically, no one does that anymore. That's old school, like film, just like having a photograph developed rather than on your phone. Digital mammography came along after that, which is kind of goes along with our computer age. The most recent innovation in mammograms is what's called 3D mammography or tomosynthesis. Basically, what that does is a traditional mammogram is taking a 3D object, the breast, and condensing it onto a 2D object, whether it's a film or whether it's on my computer screen. What 3D mammography does is it basically lets us, it's kind of like flipping through a picture book. So instead of having one image, I can flip through and it helps me see smaller lesions that might have been missed on that I might not have been able to see on a traditional mammogram. And it also helps separate out the normal density of the breast from small lesions or from just normal density overlapping. So the advance from traditional mammography to 3D has basically two benefits. One is it decreases the number of times that we think we see something and it turns out to be nothing because it was just breast density overlapping. And the other thing is it helps us find small lesions that we might have not been able to see on traditional mammograms. And I'd say most Most hospitals and imaging centers in the country are now using that 3D technology. Some of the small rural areas of the country still have traditional mammograms. So that's the advance in mammography. There are basically two other imaging modalities that can be used from a screening standpoint when it comes to breast cancer screening. One is whole breast ultrasound. So ultrasound is typically used with breast imaging to evaluate something that we saw on your screening mammogram. So if we find an abnormality, we'll do an ultrasound and say, is this a cyst or something that looks like it's fine and benign and we don't need to worry about it, or does it look suspicious enough for us to biopsy? From a screening standpoint, we take that same ultrasound technology, which uses sound waves, and basically look at the entire, both entire breasts. And what we're looking for is, again, small little densities, small little areas of abnormality that we might have not been able to see on the mammogram just based on the technology and technological limitations of a mammogram. So the question then becomes, okay, who's eligible or who do we recommend having a screening ultrasound? And the answer is not everybody. So every woman has a different density of their breast. So some women have very dense breasts, some women have less so dense breasts. And the way I think about it and kind of the way it makes sense to think about it, I think, is say you're looking out your living room window in a, you know, nice, clear, sunny winter day, and you can see a snowman in your front yard. And you can see it really clearly. That's what it's like looking at a mammogram with not dense breasts. Now imagine that same picture and you're looking out at a blizzard. You can't see the snowman as well. And that's what it's like for me trying to read a mammogram on a really dense patient. So that whole breast screening ultrasound is to help us in those patients who have dense breasts better evaluate and find small cancers that we just can't see on their mammograms because they're so dense. So whole breast screening ultrasound can be considered. And in the state of Vermont, I think it was 2018 that the state legislature passed a law that's basically says for people with dense breasts, an annual screening breast ultrasound should be paid for by their insurance company. The other modality, in addition to mammograms and ultrasounds, is MRI. MRI is a completely different imaging modality, uses a completely different kind of theory behind it. So instead of looking at densities, which is what we look at for mammograms and ultrasounds, we're really looking at structural things there. In MRI, we are looking at vascularity or blood flow. We don't do MRI on everybody. It is much more time intensive. It's more expensive. It requires an IV and IV contrast, and mammograms obviously don't require any of those things, and they're pretty quick. So screening MRIs are recommended for patients who are at a high risk of developing breast cancer. So think multiple primary family members with a history of breast cancer or ovarian cancer or other risk factors, like a known genetic mutation, like a BRCA mutation or something like that. So in those cases, we would recommend an annual, every year, screening MRI as well as a mammogram in those high-risk patients.
Dr. Boyer, thank you for really an excellent summary on how you approach breast cancer in the screening radiology department. I do want to let our listeners know this is a participatory show. We welcome your questions and comments. You can reach us on 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. In Vermont, again, that's 802-244-1777. Dr. Boyer, if you would stay on the line, I'm going to move next to Dr. David Weintritt, who is in Alexandria, Virginia. Dr. Weintritt is a breast surgeon. He grew up in Louisiana and Pensacola, Florida. He went to medical school and at the University of Florida School of Medicine in Gainesville and did his residency at New Hanover Regional Medical Center, Wilmington, North Carolina. He currently is on faculty at the Uniformed Services Medical School of the Military in Bethesda, Maryland, and at my alma mater, GW Medical School, and he heads the National Breast Center Foundation. In Alexandria, he's been named one of the top 100 doctors in the Washington metropolitan area. Welcome, Dr. Weintritt.
Thank you, Lewis. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. We want to turn to you now about, as a breast surgeon and a woman, and I want to stress, too, that men do get breast cancer. It's about 1% of breast cancer cases are diagnosed in men, but because it's 99% of cases are in women, I'm going to focus on women's breast cancer, and hopefully Dr. Eisman will talk briefly about men's breast cancer in a few minutes. But when a woman comes into your office, Dr. Weintritt, now she has has found a lump on her own exam, or has a mammogram or ultrasound that is concerning. Talk us through the steps that you take in terms of staging breast cancer.
Sure. Real quick, first, just to clarify, I was, when I was in active duty in the Air Force, staff at the Uniformed Services Health School for the medical students. I no longer have that relationship since I'm now in private practice, so just didn't want to mislead anyone there. When it comes to somebody who has a symptom or a lump, and then sort of the concept of staging, and initially we have to make sure, I always tell patients who come to my office who have a finding, either they find something, their physician who's doing clinical breast exams finds something, their routine imaging finds something. We should not move forward until we feel like there's an answer. All too often, well, and I think less and less often now, partly because as you heard how breast imaging is improving, I would hear stories in the past with a patient who said, you know, my cancer wasn't diagnosed because I felt a lump and I had a mammogram and it didn't see anything, or my doctor said I was too young, so it must not be an issue, so he didn't even send me for a mammogram. From a public service standpoint and from a standpoint of the concept of early detection, I would definitely encourage your listeners and obviously our physician colleagues to make sure that we have a very clear answer for every symptom or concern that a patient has. It doesn't mean that everybody who has breast pain or lump is going to be diagnosed with cancer, but we need to be able to look them in the eye and look ourselves in the mirror and say, yes, I have done an evaluation, and I know exactly that this patient's issue is a benign one or not. So to go back to your question about the concept of a lump and staging, if a lump indeed ends up being breast cancer, or if a mammographic finding that's biopsied ends up being a breast cancer, then at that point in time, we'll do clinical staging. We'll look to see at that moment how much do we know about the size of the mass. Obviously, if there's cancer in the breast, we also will pay attention to features like, is the skin involved? Does the mass appear a certain size? You know, staging can be characterized as less than 2 centimeters, over 2 centimeters, involving the skin attached to the chest muscle. We'll pay attention to the lymph nodes in the area, which typically are the ones under the arm. And we'll also ask the patient if they're having any other symptoms, you know, that would be concerning, constant cough or focal pain, you know, in their bones or something along those lines. Eventually, when patients have surgery, we'll more accurately stage them because we'll have a pathology report that will characterize exactly the size of the cancer, whether the lymph nodes involved or not. And for individuals who have a high-risk type of cancer who undergo systemic imaging, either with a CAT scan or bone scan or something called a PET CT scan, then we'll look to see if the cancer spread, and all of those things contribute to the stage.
Can you, Dr. Weintritt, while we have you on the line, can you talk about how breast cancer surgery has changed in the last 30 years, both in terms of the surgical diagnosis, including lymph sentinel node biopsy, and also surgery in regards to mastectomy versus lumpectomy?
Sure. Well, I would say biggest changes in breast cancer surgery would obviously be the adoption and awareness that, you know, breast conservation is a safe alternative for women who have early stage breast cancer. For women who are having mastectomy, we've definitely changed our techniques so that we can do oftentimes everything in one setting instead of multiple. But let me just take a step back and try and go through that in a stepwise manner. You know, the first thing is every patient would like to have options. And I can't echo enough the importance of early diagnosis, you know, mentioned by Dr. Boyer, that it's not that we can't still cure many women who present with late-stage diagnosis, but when appropriate screening is done and breast cancers are found at an early stage, not only is it most important for their long-term improved survival, but it then gives them multiple options when it comes to choosing their surgery. And for me, the best scenario is to be able to talk to a patient and discuss with them all of the different techniques that I'm trained to do, whether it's a relatively straightforward lumpectomy, whether we're doing breast conservation, and we're doing some more advanced, referred to as oncoplastic surgical techniques, where we're blending plastic surgery and cancer surgery, or whether someone needs medically or chooses to do mastectomy, and we're able to then provide, in many cases, immediate reconstruction so that they're able to move on from surgery much faster. You asked a question about the concept of sentinel node biopsy. Currently, when women have surgery for breast cancer or men who have surgery for breast cancer, we do a biopsy of a lymph node. As part of the staging process, that lymph node is typically underneath the arm on the side of the cancer. And the evolution of sentinel node biopsy first was awareness that if you map out the lymph nodes appropriately using either a visual dye or a nuclear medicine radioactive tracer, then if you can identify which lymph node anything from the breast would travel to first, and you remove just that lymph node, and if it's negative, you can safely leave the other ones alone. And that's a huge issue because of the potential referred to as complications or comorbidities. If we remove more lymph nodes than we need to, patients are at risk of lymphedema, which can you can have a patient with early stage breast cancer who's now saddled with a lifetime of limitations of how they use their arm. So tailoring the surgery to removing only the lymph nodes that we need to, including in some cases doing chemotherapy prior to surgery to we refer to as downstage the lymph nodes so that we can ultimately remove fewer and achieve the same result is very important. And there are techniques that continue to evolve to make the ability to visualize the sentinel nodes even better. I just completed a research study using a material called ICG or indocyanine green dye. We're collecting data on patients from a North America trial that we'll present to the FDA because the surgeons love to have options and we're looking for solutions that are safe and simple.
Let me ask you, Dr. Wench, if I could for just a minute, is it important for a woman to seek out a surgeon who specializes in breast surgery when she has a diagnosed cancer and is going to be undergoing surgery?
The specialist, so the short answer is that is yes with a caveat. The specialization in breast surgery, you don't have to only do breast cancer surgeon to be an excellent breast surgeon. I know a lot of surgeon colleagues. I myself was one for a period of time where I operated on multiple types of cancers. I still do some, actually a fair amount of thyroid cancer surgery. The key is it's a mindset and a skill set. So if the surgeon has the appropriate mindset, meaning they know the appropriate way to interpret a cancer, the appropriate interaction between the radiologist, the breast surgeon, the radiation oncologist, the medical oncologist, and they have the skill set of being able to safely provide advanced versions of breast conservation, that term oncoplastic surgery, if they're safely able to do nipple-sparing mastectomies, and have a plastic and reconstructive surgery team that they work with excellent outcomes, then it's fine if that surgeon does other things in addition to breast. But it needs to be very clear that they have the appropriate training and the focus.
Dr. Weinschritt, stay on the line with us. We're going to be going to commercial. We hope to hear from our listeners at 244-1777. We'll be back in just a moment. Dr. Lewis Myers back with Healthcare Today. I'm going to bring Dr. Alan Eisman on the line now. Dr. Eisman is at Rutland, Vermont. He undergraduate college was Stanford. He went to medical school and did his residency in internal medicine at the University of Kansas. He did a one-year fellowship in oncology at the NIH, and then his full oncology fellowship at Washington, D.C.'s and Georgetown University's famed Lombardi Cancer Center. Since 1999, he has been at the Foley Cancer Center and as its medical director and oncologist. He heads its breast care program and is head of the Rutland Area Hospice. Dr. Eisman, welcome, and thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So we've talked about the screening for breast cancer with our radiologist, Dr. Boyer. We've talked briefly with Dr. Weintraub about surgical staging and surgical treatment. Would you tell us a little bit now about the developments you've seen in the last 20 years in terms of the medical treatment of breast cancer?
I think some of the most helpful developments have been in the multidisciplinary collaborative work between radiologists, surgeons, medical oncologists, and radiation oncologists. And I think breast cancer, probably more than any other cancer type, has really led the way in collaboration, knowing that multidisciplinary evaluation and discussion amongst the different participants who are involved make the outcome the best. And we have regular tumor boards as our conferences are occurring across the country where new cases of cancer are discussed, and because breast cancer is so common, breast cancer cases are discussed frequently, and it's a huge advantage to have representation from all of the different disciplines who are involved, because breast cancer is not just a single modality treatment area. So that's one of the things, is just the discussion and the collaboration. Screening has made a huge difference, and the popularity and the attention to making people aware of the importance of screening has made a difference, so that we can now see people at a much earlier stage. Probably 80% of the patients that we see have early stage disease, and this allows us not only to make diagnoses early, but to treat people for cure early. One of the things in early stage diagnosis, however, is how do we predict the future? How do we know whether a cancer might be a higher risk for recurrence? And people have looked at a variety of techniques, but the most popular now is looking at genes that are a part of the cancer itself. So it's a screening profile of the genes that are in a cancer. And one of the several that are out in availability is one that's called Oncotype, which is run by one of the companies that is available in the United States. And this is a 21-gene assay that looks at whether or not there is a higher risk based on a score that is generated from looking at the presence or absence of the genes that are in the tumor itself. And the reason that we do this is to try to ensure our understanding of the risk of the cancer, but also to try to reduce the number of patients who would need chemotherapy. One of the changes over the years is understanding that we were probably over-treating patients. We were giving too much chemotherapy, often to people who really didn't need it or would not benefit from it. And this genetic screening, not a hereditary genetic screening, but a gene screening within the tumor itself, gives us a score that can reliably tell us that a patient with an early stage breast cancer does not need chemotherapy and will not benefit from the addition of chemotherapy. And conversely, we not very often, but we still do see a small percentage of patients for whom we might have said chemotherapy probably is not needed in the past, but now with this Oncotype scoring, we find some patients have a high score where we say, you know, we wouldn't have recommended this in the past, but now with this score, you really do have an increased risk of recurrence, and chemotherapy should be added to the after-surgical and after-radiation treatment.
Breast cancer is not a monolithic disease, correct? I mean, we can talk about premenopausal breast cancer, postmenopausal breast cancer, and the various types of breast cancer.
That's correct, although the majority of
breast cancers come down to evaluation by stage. We worry more about premenopausal breast cancer because frequently it is more aggressive. But the majority of breast cancer does occur in postmenopausal women, women who've already gone into and are beyond menopause. So from that point of view, we have pre- and postmenopausal breast cancer, but from the evaluation from a staging point of view, the management really comes down to the staging.
Can you talk about the difference between hormonal treatments and chemotherapy?
So breast cancers have early on been understood to be driven by estrogen. And inside the breast cancer cell, there is a receptor called the estrogen receptor. And the estrogen, by binding to the estrogen receptor, is, in a way, if you want to think about it, like fertilizer. The estrogen causes the breast cancer cell to grow. And there are drugs that can block that interaction or change the interaction between estrogen and the estrogen receptor. So some of the hormonal or endocrine treatments are medicines that are taken by mouth. There's one that's given by injection that block the interaction or change the interaction between estrogen in the woman's body and the estrogen receptor, and thereby reduce the ability to encourage the breast cancer cell to grow. Chemotherapy in general, it's a somewhat crude analogy, but if one thinks about it like weed killer, chemotherapy is medicine that's usually given intravenously. There are some oral medicines, but the purpose is to kill cells in a variety of ways, either by damaging their DNA or interfering with protein synthesis so that cells can't continue to grow.
Is chemotherapy, are chemotherapy regimens getting better?
They're getting better in the sense that they're becoming a little bit more specific, so they're more targeted to individual types of damage that they can cause. The side effects of some of the newer medicines are fewer, so the ability of people to tolerate the chemotherapy is improved. Probably the biggest advantage is some of the drugs that block some of the chemotherapy side effects. So we have a huge improvement in nausea control or in patients' ability to put up with the chemotherapy itself.
Once a woman has been treated for breast cancer, whether surgery, chemotherapy, or both, how can you predict whether her risk of having a recurrence?
So the staging, when someone is originally diagnosed, is the term used to consider the extent of the disease. But since most women have an early stage diagnosis, it becomes difficult. There are two major groups to think about: those who have estrogen receptors that are positive and those who do not. And that in and of itself is a predictor for recurrence. The estrogen receptor positive patients have a lower risk of recurrence. But there are a few other risk factors. One is a separate protein called HER2, HER-2. HER2 is a protein that sits on the surface of the breast cancer cells. And if it's in higher abundance, if the breast cancer cell makes more of that protein, that is a higher risk for future recurrence. And fortunately, there are medicines that are built specifically against that protein. And there's one subtype that has neither the estrogen receptor nor the HER2 protein, and that group has the highest risk of recurrence. And so we are able now to stratify based on some of these characteristics that the pathologists are able to tell us when they analyze the breast cancer when it's first diagnosed. So those analyses, in addition to stage, sometimes are given as predictors for the future.
I mentioned early on that approximately 1% of breast cancers are diagnosed in men. Can you talk briefly about how that often presents and if the treatments are any different?
The presentation is usually of a mass in the breast, a little bit outside of the central part of the breast, a little bit below what's called the areola. And it's usually a solid, usually not a tender mass, and because men usually are not as aware that they can get breast cancer, sometimes those tumors are a little bit larger before men seek medical attention. Most of the time, as in women, breast cancer only occurs on one side, although they can sometimes occur on both, but the majority is just on one side. And the majority of male breast cancers are very similar to the behavior of female breast cancers. They're mostly estrogen receptor positive. They usually are found at a time when the lymph nodes are negative in the underarm on the same side as the breast cancer. And the management, because these are usually estrogen receptor positive, after appropriate surgical management and recovery, men frequently will have radiation, or if they have mastectomies, will just go on to have hormonal therapy.
And finally, and I can open this up to any of our any of the three doctors, let's talk a little bit about prevention and about exposures. What are some of the ways we can, aside from the actual doing mammograms and screening, what are some of the ways people can try and prevent breast cancer? And I'll ask specifically, for example, about environmental exposures and also sort of self-induced exposures with alcohol and tobacco. Dr. Eisman?
Well, Lewis.
Dr. Weintraut?
David Weintraut. Yeah, no, you know, I'm happy to take a stab at this, and we'll appreciate some other input as well. Given Breast Cancer Awareness Month, we have a foundation that we started, so a lot of our efforts throughout the year, especially the month of October, involve access and education and technology. So, and I get asked this question, as I'm sure my colleagues do regularly, either how did this happen because I'm healthy, or what I do going forward. And I try to make it simple for folks and think of the trifecta of diet, activity, and exercise. Diet, activity, and exercise leading to, like, weight management, meaning avoid processed foods, eat healthy organic food, exercise regularly, and control your BMI. And those things, while they're not necessarily easy, they are easy to understand, and they lead to, in many cases, for cancers like breast cancer, but also potentially for colorectal cancers and uterine cancer, a reduction in getting a disease, a reduction potentially in the disease coming back, and less likely for someone to die from that disease.
Dr. Eisman?
I certainly agree that that's a great approach, Dr. Weintraut. The other is, especially from a family history point of view, is if you know your family history, there are genes that run in families, BRCA1 and BRCA2 in particular, that increase a person's risk of developing breast and other types of cancers, but particularly breast cancer. This is a little bit different from the question you're asking in terms of prevention, but this goes to screening a higher risk group. And so knowing your family history has become a much easier thing to do, not only in terms of our talking about cancers and our health in general, but also all of the available 23andMe type genetic analyses. But if you know that you have an increased risk, or you know your family history, earlier screening or more detailed screening can often be a helpful way of at least finding a cancer earlier. It's not truly prevention, it's more early screening, but it's an important thing that we should be mentioning as part of our discussion.
Thank you. And I'm going to turn, in our last few minutes, I'm going to turn to each of the doctors and ask about what they see as future developments. And Dr. Boyer, there's been some discussion about artificial intelligence and the reading of mammograms and other radiologic screenings. But in regards to mammograms, do you see a role in the near future or the more distant future for AI, and how will that affect the work you do?
Yeah, so I do see a role, and the question becomes, what is the role? So we've been using for years now in the radiology field, we've been using an entity called CAD, or computer-aided detection, in reading mammograms. And what that basically is it's a computer tool that basically serves as a second opinion. So we would review a mammogram and then see what the computer says. And frequently it'll point out areas that it sees as abnormality and just kind of aids us in reading that mammogram. I think there's a big opportunity for AI or advanced computer algorithms to improve that process, to improve kind of the second reader or radiology assistance component of reading a mammogram, just to make our interpretation of the mammogram better. Because the ultimate goal in reading a mammogram is to find all of the cancers that exist and never call a woman back for more imaging for a benign entity, right? And I think AI can help bridge that gap and make us and some of the performance metrics better. I don't see it replacing radiologists or replacing human, you know, physicians actually reading your mammogram at any time in the near future. But I do see it kind of making the process and the outcomes better.
Dr. Weintraut, breast cancer surgery has clearly changed. Beginning in the 1980s, we moved away from the radical mastectomies for practically every woman having surgery into these lumpectomies, breast conserving surgeries. We now have the sentinel node biopsy, which reduces lymphedema, as you noted. So we're making great progress. What developments do you see in the future? And can I ask what led you to specialize in breast cancer surgery?
I'll answer the latter part first. So as is usually the case, cancer has touched most families. And in my situation, I had a grandmother who died from ovarian cancer while I was in medical school, which was quite a while ago. And so we didn't have a tremendous amount of information at that time about genetics and preventative care, although we certainly had some awareness. And more close to home, my wife's mother died from breast cancer at an early age, actually a month before my wife and I met. So once I started doing surgery and surgical oncology, I realized that the sky was the limit, and that so much research was being put into breast cancer, and that if I wanted a career that from that day I committed to focusing on breast cancer to the day I retired was constantly going to evolve and change, and I was going to have a really big opportunity to advocate for my patients, that was going to be my choice. So that's the story of how I decided to focus on breast cancer surgery. When it comes to us improving operations, it's interesting that term you mentioned, artificial intelligence. We gather a tremendous amount of information before surgery, pathology reports, MRI imaging, ultrasound imaging. We talk about surgical planning. And then we sometimes don't have access to a lot of information during surgery. So some of the things that we're working on when it comes to doing breast conservation or lumpectomy is technology that can help with something called margin assessment. When we're removing a cancer, obviously we don't want to leave the operating room until we removed all of the cancer. But sometimes there can be microscopic elements that we're just not that aware of, even sophisticated imaging doing, you know, with mammography and ultrasound during surgery. So technology that can actually look at or touch the surface of the tissue that we take out and tell us whether we got all the cancer or not is an active area of investigation and will reduce the need for a lot of women to have second or third surgeries. We do something called perfusion imaging. When we're doing complex operations involving reconstruction, we'll do perfusion imaging by looking at the active blood flow to the tissue that we're operating on, so we'll know how much of the reconstruction we can safely do in that moment. And so it gives us the opportunity to do one-stage surgeries for many women, but also to avoid unnecessary risk of complications like tissue breakdown, infection, things that we really want to avoid. And we do that by using technology to tell us information that we can't tell for ourselves.
Thank you. And thank you for sharing why you went into this specialty area of surgery. Dr. Eisman, talk about the future in our last few minutes. And also, if I may ask you, you've been an oncologist for 20 years. It's a difficult area of medicine to be in. You do lose a lot of patients just by the nature of the disease. You also are the director of the hospice center in Rutland. Tell me why you went into oncology briefly and what keeps you hopeful and keeps you moving forward.
Well, thanks again for having all of us on, Lou. It's an important topic. One of the things about oncology in general compared to other fields of internal medicine, and I'll say that I early on learned what I was not, which was not a surgeon, but in the field of internal medicine, there aren't many subfields, cardiology, pulmonary, endocrinology, where diseases can be cured. They can be managed, and there are huge advances in managing these other areas of internal medicine. But oncology was one area where cures could actually occur, where someone could be diagnosed with a serious, even potentially life-threatening illness, and could be cured. And I was hopeful as I went into the field in the early 90s with new developments in molecular biology, that there would be a better understanding of what really caused cancer, and then as a result, there would be treatments that would be applied that would be curative. And in many respects, that has occurred. And we are using cancer therapies now that were developed through laboratory advances in the 90s and in the early 2000s that have then been translated into medicines that we currently use that have truly led to a reduction in morbidity, but especially a reduction in death related to cancers. And I think that's really where the future is the science and particularly the molecular understanding of what causes cancers. One of the biggest questions, and one that you asked earlier, was how can we predict the future for someone who's been diagnosed through some of the new techniques that Dr. Boyer mentioned or from the improved surgery that Dr. Weintraub mentioned? And that could be looking at DNA that's floating around in the blood, so what's called cell-free DNA. And these are techniques that are rapidly advancing in terms of our understanding, and whether through a blood test we would be able to determine whether someone continues to be free of cancer or they have the earliest signs of recurrence of their cancer. And then what could we do about additional detection and perhaps therapy at the earliest time instead of a more advanced time, when someone's cancer may have spread beyond our ability to cure it or at least effectively treat it.
I want to thank you, Dr. Eisman, Dr. Weintraub, and Dr. Boyer for coming in and talking to us today about breast cancer. It's clear we're making tremendous progress. I want to encourage all of the people who may be listening who either have had breast cancer or family members who have had breast cancer, keep fighting, keep hope alive, because we are making progress. We're going to continue to make progress. So I want to thank all of our guests. I want to tell you next week, we will be sort of going in a different direction. We're going to be looking at wilderness medicine. How do you, when you go out, whether you're skiing or hiking or sailing or whatever, what kind of things do you need to do to prepare yourself when you go out into the wilderness? I know a lot of people in Vermont do enjoy going out and about. My guest will be Dr. Richard Ingebretson, who is essentially now the Dean of Wilderness Medicine. He's from out in Utah. So we look forward to talking to you again next week. In the meantime, take good care of yourselves. Written and produced by Armin Bayajian.